Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello, and welcome to GoTo Unscripted, coming to you from GoTo Amsterdam 2024. My name is James Lewis, and I'm so pleased to be with you here today with
Charity Majors.
And I've been a big fan of yours and the work you've been doing, especially obviously with observability with Honeycomb for a number of years now. So I hope you don't mind me saying that, a bit of a fanboy.
No, thank you. Thank you. That's very sweet.
It's been a really exciting journey, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, it's been a very exciting journey full of near-death company experiences.
Right. So you were talking today, you did the keynote this morning, which was fantastic, fabulous, I loved it.
Thank you.
Just wanted to say that. On whether it's time for a version change in terms of how we define observability. Now, I have to admit, when I saw the title, I was thinking, do you mean like version of logs? What is it, schema versions? So what do you mean by, is it time for a version change?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I feel like we spent, a few years arguing about observability and how it's different from monitoring. And this led to a few years where I felt like my entire life was just correcting people on Twitter about terminology, which does not make you a lot of friends. You're just like, you are literally the, well, actually, guy. It's not super fun. And I feel like we've come to this place where it's kind of been generic. Like, in the beginning, I was like, we're going to make a unique technical definition for observability. Mm. But, like, you don't actually get all of the say. Like, the market has a lot of say. Mm. And other engineers have a lot of say in this. And the term kind of got diluted. So, at this point, I think of observability as being just, an attribute of complex systems. Just like performance or reliability. But there's been this like sort of massive step function, like discontinuous leap in recent years when it comes to everything from the cost model to how you store. And like this is where like the idea of, okay, what is semantic versioning? It's about if you're bumping the major version, it better be a breaking backwards incompatible change. Yeah. And I think that the observability 1.0 versus 2.0 is very clarifying for a lot of people, because observability 1.0 tools are metrics, logs, and traces, right? Your storing and your RUM tools and your APM tools and your profiling tools and your tracing tools and your all these different tools. And what connects them? Nothing. You, the engineer, who's sitting here kind of like eyeballing shapes and going, well, that's probably that, copy-pasting ideas around. And observability 2.0 is very simple. It's you have a single source of truth. Mm-hmm. You have these arbitrarily wide structured data blobs, and you can slice and dice, and you can zoom in, you can zoom out, you can derive metrics and logs and traces. But since you have a single source of truth, all of that context gets preserved, which, like, it's very simple. You have many sources of truth, or you have one, but the socio-technical implications are just massive.
I'm old enough to remember before observability was 1.0, maybe.
Yeah.
I remember back in the day, around about 2010, 2011, there was a guy called Coda Hale. His Twitter handle.
Love Coda Hale.
Right? And his metrics libraries were the first libraries
I
started using, right? It was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely awesome.
Yeah.
Can you just maybe like talk us through how things have evolved since back then? Because I know, you were saying in your keynote, it was about 2016, 2015 you coined the term.
Yeah.
But there'd been this giant explosion of things happening before that.
StatsD was a brilliant innovation for its time. It was like a generic interface to telemetry for engineers. Mm-hmm. And at the time, storage, computing resources were extremely expensive and scarce.
Yeah.
And like the metric is just a number, right? And so you were deriving the absolute least amount of information that you could to get insights out of it. And like, God bless, like that carried us for decades.
Right, yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's amazing. But ultimately the metric is really it's the data type that you should be using to summarize vast quantities of data. And like the metric was also really useful in the days when your architecture was very simple. You had the web tier, the app tier, the database, singular, you know? And so like all the real complexity was bound up inside your lines of code.
Right. Yeah,
so it was tractable. If all else failed, you could just attach a debugger and step through it, right? Well, what's happened over the past 10 years? Well, we blew up the monolith.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Now, right? Patient zero here. We've got all these services. We've got all these third-party APIs. We've got so many different storage systems. And like so much of the complexity no longer lives inside your code. It's outside of your code. In the system, everything is a high cardinality dimension. Yeah. The debugging is no longer a question of finding the code and fixing. Like, that's the easy part.
Yeah.
The hard part is finding where in the system is the code that you need to find to fix and solve. And so it's just a very different universe.
I remember you saying again earlier about how you were, how one of the things you used to love, you were when it was still Facebook, I guess, was being the smartest debugger in the room kind of thing.
The debugger of last resort.
The debugger of last resort, that was the phrase.
Yeah.
I love that phrase. Yeah. That's a really cool phrase.
I think a lot of us identify with that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Once you get your head around the system enough, then you
built
suddenly
it, you've seen all the ways it can fail, you've got this, you know, you can pattern match to the best of them, you know? And it does feel really good. but it really doesn't scale.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was very humbling, almost humiliating. We'll stick with humbling. For me, when I was at Facebook at Parse, and these, you know, fairly junior engineers came along and they just started feeding some data sets into Scuba. And suddenly, these things that, like, only I could, you know, get out of, you know, I could figure it out, even though the data didn't say it. Suddenly, these very junior engineers were just like, bop, 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 well, it looks like it's that. And I was just like,
uh-huh.
The hell? You know, and it was like, I guess I need to learn this modern tooling too, you know? But like, which is a little like for cranky people like us, you know, it's like, okay, but like, it's so healthy. It's so healthy if everyone, if the connective tissue, if the context, if it sits in a tool instead of relying on our head, it means that the best debuggers aren't the people who have been there the longest anymore. It's the people who are the most curious.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that idea.
Yeah.
It's curiosity drives that.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Curiosity and your habits. Like, habits do so much work for us as engineers. Like it's one thing, the things you do during exceptional times, right? But it's the habits that really drive us.
I remember a long time ago talking with Daniel Tuhos North about his time at one fintech. It was a commodity trading firm, and it was about one of the, probably he said it was either the first or second best programmer he'd ever met or ever worked with. And the one thing they did when he first started pairing with this guy, he came over and he said, well, let me show you the test. He said, no, run it and show me the logs. And I thought that's quite a profound thing, actually, right? You know, because yes, I can see the test and see, but actually, if the logs don't tell me enough about the running system, then like, how am I ever going to work with this long term?
It's such a profound mental shift. And I feel like in so many ways, where we are right now as an industry, we're in the early days of observability in the way that I feel like 20 years ago, we were in the early days of TDD and test-driven development, where it feels very manual, it feels very awkward, it feels very unnecessary, it feels kind of excessive, you know? It's like, why do I need to figure out how to add, like, I know how it works, you know? I've got my dashboards, like, why do I need to, like, turn, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And like, for a long time, it was like, why do I need my unit tests, you know? And it is kind of manual at the moment, because, to be completely honest, like, you have to have tooling to support like higher level tooling. You know, what we've got right now is like, there are not many places where you can get like raw events and slice and dice and all this stuff. And it's an absolute prerequisite. You can't do that built on top of aggregates and exemplars, you know?
Right.
So the industry is going to have to advance a bit, but it's going to get there because your code passing tests does not tell you it's working.
That's really interesting.
It tells you at best that your code probably is logically correct.
Yeah, and so I mean, I'm a colleague, Minion Martin.
Maybe Martin is great. Yeah,
I saw him speak about observability driven development. A couple of years ago, maybe 18 months ago, maybe 2 years ago. And I was trying to think about what it reminded me of, and it reminded me a bit about how you've gone from a sort of closed to an open system, and then you had TDD and you're driving out your unit test. Then we started with doing acceptance test driven development when you're driving out from acceptance test. Yeah. Then we started doing almost even further out where we were running the whole thing and almost doing like running the whole thing, standing up a JVM. You didn't need to stand up a JVM, but driving like the APIs from tests. Yeah. And it seems like we're moving outwards now. And it also, when you talk about debugging, it also made me think about, like, I always used to joke, like, I haven't opened a debugger in years, right? Because I've got enough coverage in my test suite to know that things are correct. Is that how you see this evolving?
Yeah, there are so many, like, similarities and, like, parallels. Because, you know, when I talk about debugging, like, you don't know if your code works until you watch it run in production, you know? And I feel like our model of debugging and monitoring and observability, like, for so long, it's focused around problems and errors and bugs. And, like, we've kind of trained ourselves to not even look at production unless there's a problem or we get paged. There's so much that goes into understanding your software. It doesn't have anything to do with, like, something being down or paging you. And, like, we're engineers. We like to understand things. Yeah. You know, we are curious. Like, I feel like anytime I encounter somebody who's just like, oh, I'm just like, who hurt you? Because it has to get drummed out of you, you know, to be like, oh, God, I don't want to look at it. Because inherently, we're so curious about it. And, like, being able to understand your software, it's what informs how you spend your time. Like, whether or not what you built was being used or not. Like, and one of the things, Austin Parker, who I work with, has said some really stuff that I can't get out of my head, which is about how, like, if observability turns out to just be, like, better monitoring, well, we will have lost, because so much of it is about blending business metrics with application and system metrics.
Yeah.
Like, it's so weird, if you think about it, that we're all, like, walled off from each other. Every interesting question that you want to ask is probably a blend of business and application and systems.
And it absolutely changes behavior. I mean, I remember, just as to share a story, I was on a team many years ago now, and we put this set of microservices in production, and we were kind of curious about how it was performing, so we had lots of stuff around latency. It was, don't tell anyone, it was a CQRS implementation. but we had, you know, we were measuring kind of, you know, the latency between writes and reads, so we could make sure that we weren't ever, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But the biggest breakthrough came when someone said, I wonder how much money this is making.
Oh.
And no one knew, right? No one knew. But someone said, but I'm sure finance know what, like, per click on the link is, like, you know, roughly. So someone went down to the finance team and said, hey, can you, how much do we on average make every time someone clicks the thing? And so we started graphing that and said, that's quite a lot of money, actually, this thing is worth, right? So maybe we should start taking things a little bit more seriously. And not that we had everything was automated anyway, but suddenly the mind shift, seeing those business metrics,
value.
Just amazing.
You know, one of our earliest, Intercom was one of our earliest, you know, back when I was in charge of marketing and I was like, high cardinality is a great marketing term. Somebody Intercom thought so too. One guy was like, that's a great marketing term. But, like, one of the first things they did was they instrumented their services with app IDs. And so, like, as I recall the story, they were on the verge of having to do this giant MySQL migration. Like, their database had exceeded the maximum size you could do in AWS. And so they're like, well, it's time to shard. It's time to partition, all this stuff. And this engineer instrumented their code with, you know, Honeycomb and app IDs and just started, like, poking around and went, 80% of our execution time is being taken up by one customer who's paying us $20 a month. So maybe we don't need to do this year-long migration. maybe we throttle this guy or charge him a lot. Like, maybe we
everyone.
Right? But like, this is not, like, we have so little visibility into what's happening in our systems.
Yeah.
And it really takes that curiosity.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like the tools that we have punish curiosity. Like, how often have you seen, or you put someone new on call and they're like poking around with their little grasshopper, you know, hat, and they're like, this is interesting. What's happening here? And your instinct is to go, oh, grasshopper, like, just don't even look. Like, I've done this so many times. It's going to take you down a rabbit hole for 2 days. You're not going to find anything. It's going to, like, you have product work to do. It punishes you. But if it rewards you instead, if you can quickly go, oh, this weird thing is, you know, the intersection of, this is what I love about, we have this thing in Honeycomb called Bubble Up, which is like, if you're instrumenting your code with these wide events, and you can have a graph, if you're curious about it, you draw a little bubble around it. I'm like, this is Spike, I'm curious, draw a little bubble. And we'll compute for inside the bubble, baseline outside, and sort and diff them. So then it's like, well, here's something I care about, that's weird. And you're like, oh, those are all Android devices with this particular build ID and this particular like return string and using this language pack in this region of the world. It's just like, you're like, oh, now I know what the problem is, you know? Because so much of debugging is just, here's the thing I care about. Why do I care about
it? Yeah. It's amazing. One thing I'm kind of fascinated by in this kind of world, and I have been for a very long time, I've talked about business metrics, is I still don't get why the giant, okay, maybe this is going a bit too far, but why the giant products that you have to spend all the money on are still absolutely leaders in this. And I know it's been basically because of marketing spend, right? Because, I mean, I remember being on a thing where, you know, it was going to take us, I remember we had it in the backlog. You know, sometime before launch, we have to implement insert giant vendor thing here that's going to instrument your thing. I mean, it kept getting pushed back and pushed back, and then in the end, we had nothing.
Yeah.
But actually, what we ended up doing is doing very simple instrumentation, very a simple set.
It wasn't valuable to you while you were developing it, so it just gets shunted to the end.
Yeah. And I think that's a bit of a problem. And this is back to observability-driven development, right?
Part of your development process, if you're like validating yourself at every step, you're like, I just shipped a thing. Is it working like I expected it to do? Right? If you like, I feel like so much of this is like almost muscle memory.
Yeah.
Like, you just like, there's this feeling in your body where you're like, well, I've committed it and it's done and I'm going home for the day. And like, it's about moving that marker away from my test pass to I've watched people using it in production and I've looked at my telemetry, right? And then you can feel okay and you can leave for the day.
One thing I was super excited about today that I can't believe I hadn't heard the term before was canonical
logs.
Yeah, and I feel ashamed, deeply embarrassed.
It should be way more widely known because it's revolutionary and it's not new. Brandon, I forget his name, but an engineer while he was at Stripe, he named it. So the idea of canonical logs is this. So with normal logs, your request is executing through your service and you're just like, here's something, log it, just kind of schizo, you know, just like, boop. So if you actually ever want to do anything with it, you have to go and sort of like do a bunch of sed and awk or whatever to sort of recombine it. So the idea of canonical logging is this. When your request enters a service, you initialize an empty struct. You pre-populate it with anything you know, like any parameters getting passed in, anything you already know about it. Then while it's executing,
kind of pass a mode out of context around, essentially.
Yeah, is it you
like a thread
pass
local,
it
whatever
around.
It is in whatever construct
anything,
you have.
Anything, you're like, oh, I'm writing up, shopping cart ID, might be useful someday. Drop it in the blob, right? App ID, you know, username, user ID, like anything you're just like, might be useful someday, just drop it in the blob. You can get fancy, you can be like anything in /proc, drop it in the blob. Language internals, drop it in the blob, whatever. Drop it and forget it. And then when your request gets to the end, it's ready to exit or error, you ship it all off to your storage, one very wide structured event. So all of that context for that request and service is knit together.
Yeah, right.
And this isn't, like, I learned years after starting Honeycomb, AWS has been doing this in their backend services forever. And it's literally just a text file and slash something or other. But like, I would honestly rather have these wide structured events plus grep than almost any other debugging solution on the market, because it's so powerful.
I mean, I can almost see a secondary industry, though, in formatting stuff you dump into structured logs, right? Because you can just imagine, like, you've got you've got multiple people working on software, and suddenly you're going to have uppercase, lowercase. You're going to have, there's definitely an open source library in there that's going to, like, basically streamline
open
first
telemetry.
Name is this, and it's going to be camel case, or it's going to be this. I know.
Like, there's a need for a lot of, like, sort of like tooling on this to, like, so, like, you actually, one of the interesting things about Observability 2.0 is you don't want schemas or indexes or anything that assume that you can predict in advance what data is going to be valuable. But at the same time, you also don't want chaos and madness. So you want some sort of, like, implicit schema, or, like, you know, some sort of, like, you know, resolution, you know, something that automatically converts camel case to, like, or something like that.
Yeah,
both of these things are true, and it doesn't exist right now, so it's very manual.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come.
I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
This literally has only just occurred to me, so I don't know. This is probably something that's completely stupid, but there's been, in the kind of data space, data warehouse space, there's been obviously been an evolution away from the old traditional kind of data warehouses, star schemas and stuff,
ETLs,
towards, like, data lakes, and then again away from data lakes towards data pipelines, and then even now an evolution again towards things like data products. So each service is offering up their data as a product. Is that something you see in terms with observability, or is that just a slight, is that orthogonal to
it? It's like related and also not. You know, I hear the term data observability and I was like, well, this is interesting. Sounds like my people. And so I investigated a little. And it means something a little different than when I talk about observability. Data observability has a lot to do with, like, you know, you've got a schema, but, like, some events might be sparse or rare, but, like, how sparse is too sparse? How do you know when it stopped sending something versus it's just, you know, not very common? Like, how do you validate that schemas are getting, you know, how do you version those schemas? How do you, you know, and it's really interesting, and it aligns, I think, a lot with the kind of observability I talk about, but it's just different enough that it's like you've got to do some manual stuff to glue them together, which some people do. I think it's super interesting time to be in data, though.
It certainly is. It certainly is. I mean, but it also is a super expensive time in terms of cost.
And this is something where I feel like software engineers, it always kind of surprised me, like, software engineers are not all that literate in data stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, the idea that anytime you're using a data model and data storage type that is not right for your use case, your costs are going to go like this. And this is where I feel like people who are buying observability tools haven't quite reckoned with the fact that the data model that is based on metrics are just, like, there's no relational data stored in a time series database. Yeah. It's so expensive to try and store any kind of, not even high cardinality, but, like, itty bitty, 100 things. It's just like, whoa, it's not the right tool for the job. And people are just running into, you know, after I wrote that blog post on the cost crisis in observability tooling, I heard from so many observability teams, and I'm talking like people who are at the peak of their craft, experts in this domain, and they all feel kind of ashamed and embarrassed because they're like, we spend an outright majority of our time as a team just trying to manage costs. Like, not even like automating or building libraries or doing something that will fix, but just, like, manually monitoring and massaging. And I'm just like, this is such a smell. Yeah. Wrong data model.
I had this conversation, I won't say with who or, but it was, shall we say, about the infrastructure at a large fintech. And I think their production infrastructure was something like, four fairly meaty EC2 instances running Kubernetes with a bunch of containers on them. But then their observability infrastructure, they had 40. It was literally an order of magnitude more like infrastructure to manage their observability requirements, right?
Such a smell.
And it's, yeah, right. Yeah. And it's, yeah. But it's, I mean, it's astonishing. Like, actually.
But like, I also, I don't want to like talk shit about, because like, vendors like, you know, Datadog or like, you know, Prometheus, like, these are phenomenal tools.
Yeah, sure.
Phenomenal.
I'm glad you said that about Prometheus. Phil Calzado, who's a former colleague and good friend of mine, he's Prometheus.
They're very well engineered, architected. Like, these are the last best metrics-based tools
right,
we're ever
exactly,
going to get
built. And they were game changers when they came out.
They were game changers, and they're now mature. Mm. You know, the tooling is exquisite. It's just, you got to know the use case, or it's just not going to work, you know? And, like, infrastructure, great use case for metrics, because you're not... Like with application data, you literally only want to aggregate around every user's experience, which is a very high cardinality dimension. But when it comes to infrastructure, you want to aggregate around the CPU or the disk. Or, you know, there are lots of use cases where metrics are the right tool for the job. They just get out of their lane and then you run into trouble.
I love the idea of getting out of their lane and running into trouble. That's I'm totally, can I borrow that? Do you mind if I just
take
that?
Absolutely, take it.
I'll use it for all the things.
Do it.
So, I mean, going forwards, observability 2.0, it's okay. It's a bit silly to say what's 3.0 look like, but what does the future hold? What does the future hold in your, you know, if you could wave a magic wand and look, you know, in a little bit into the future, what does it look like for you, for the company, for the world, for, you know, the world of software and application development?
I feel like there are so many interesting trends in software that I feel like we are sitting kind of at the nexus of, like putting software engineers on call for their systems and the sort of like the rise and fall of DevOps, you know, is a thing where like ops teams just kind of are becoming less and less of the thing. So DevOps. You know, like the end state is every engineer writes code, every engineer owns the code that they write, you know? Platform engineering is, I think, so interesting because it's bringing product discipline to infrastructure for the first time. You know, the end of the zero interest rate phenomenon is, I think, forcing us to, like, build or relearn these muscles when it comes, like you were talking about, connecting what we do to dollars and cents, which is the universal denominator, right? We should all, like, cost is a property of systems. Every architecture should care about this. And I think that all these things are so good for us. You know, I think that, like, for such a long time, in like, the C-suites, I feel like the VP of engineering has been, like, the junior member of the squad because we've been like, well, we're artists, you know? We can't translate the work that we do into something that, which just means that you
possibly understand.
You couldn't possibly understand, which is not a good thing.
No, right.
It's not a good thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like these are all kind of long-term trends. I feel like, to be a little bit arrogant for a moment or whatever, I feel like the model that we have sketched out over the past few years about, you know, wide events, high cardinality, it is the inevitable end state. Like, whether or not Honeycomb succeeds or fails, it's just the only way to handle software at scale. And it's been really fun to just, like, you can't really explain this to, I mean, it just takes a long time to explain. The attention spans are like this, you know, which I get. But I think that over the next few years, I think you'll start to see more companies and startups who are built in this kind of model. There's some really interesting ones that have been kind of startup just based on ClickHouse, which I think is really exciting.
Yeah.
It needs to be commodity. It needs to be open source. It needs to be more, you know, competitive. But I think we're going to see some really interesting design innovations. Like, so much of this is a mental model shift away from a world where with logs and with metrics, it's like you need to predict in advance what questions you're going to want to ask, and you need to know what strings you're searching for in order to find them. And the world of observability 2.0 is much more like, I don't know what I'm looking for. I just know that something's wrong, but I don't know why. Right? And being able to quickly, like, and being comfortable with that, being comfortable with, like, sort of analysis first instead of search first. Like, this is a design problem.
And as you were saying earlier, hypothesis first.
Hypothesis first. Right. You know, the exciting thing to me about this is that it's such a leveler. Democratizer is an overused term, but it's like, you know, you don't want to join a team and be like, well, I can never catch up. I can never be the expert in these systems, right? Like, it's a way of, you know, I think we're looking for ways to kind of take people's hands and lead them into the future, because it's so much easier. It is so, the way people are doing it now is so hard and so expensive. And we've been doing it for decades. We're just like, well, we know it, but it's not, it's so hard. And it can just be so much easier. And so that's where, that's like, you know, people are always like, what's the biggest hurdle we have? And like I said in my talk, it's that people don't believe a better world is possible. Yeah. And I get it. We've all been told things by vendors. But it's not that the world's going to be easy. It's that, you know, there are tools that obscure complexity and tools that try to make complexity tractable. Mm. And that's where I hope observability is going.
So I think that's probably a brilliant place to end. So
the world is going to be
so much easier. Making complexity tractable through Observability 2.0. Thank you so much, Charity.
Thanks for having me.
It's been absolutely brilliant chatting. My name is James Lewis.
Charity Majors.
Thank you for listening to GoTo Unscripted again, coming from GoTo Amsterdam. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.